listeners. This is Cherry and Natalie from With Chinese Characteristics podcast. Today we're back with an exciting new episode.
Wow.
That was hard.
No, I don't think it was that bad. So, don't you have something you need to read, though, before we talk about today's episode?
I have to admit my faults.
Yeah.
So.
Struggle session.
In one of our most recent episodes about panda diplomacy, I've assumed that pandas cannot acclimate to coldness and survive in a place like the Moscow Zoo. And thanks to our listener, Kay, who kindly wrote to us and let us know that it's actually quite the opposite. Pandas have a fear of heat, however, they can adapt to cold climate pretty well, and they have very thick fur, which helps to insulate them. So if you Google panda in the snow, you will see many adorable videos and pictures of pandas playing in the snow with no fear of the coldness.
Well, we apologize if we offended the honor of pandas.
Yes, and we try our best to fact check our writings and materials with any historical context and backgrounds. But, you know, somehow this one didn't make it, so here's the correction, and I want to say thank you to the listener who wrote to us.
Yep, thank you very much. Now we have a topic, Cherry, that might get us a lot of angry emails.
Oh, no.
Which is, we're going to talk about the First Opium War.
Okay.
Or, as it was at the time, just the Opium War. They didn't know there was going to be a second. They didn't know there was going to be a sequel.
Yes.
Last episode, we talked about, prior to the First Opium War, how maybe from the outside to some Europeans, China still looked the same. But internally, there was a lot of problems. There was problems with the money. There was problems with rebellion, with pirates.
Population growth.
Ethnic tension between different groups in the government. Opium. So all sorts of tensions going on. The military was weak. And all this leads into the First Opium War. So now we're going to go back to our friends, the British. Our best friends, the British, and see what they're up to as we go into this time period. So in 1833, the Honorable East India Company lost its mandate for... That's its name, Cherry. It's the Honorable East India Company.
Is that actually part of the name?
Well, it has different names, but one of the names is the Honorable, or just the Honorable Company.
Okay. I just always known it as the East India Company, but okay.
It lost its mandate for trade in China. Previously, as the only avenue of trade between the United Kingdom and China, the EIC had fulfilled multiple roles. Not only facilitating trade, it also handled negotiation, dealt with piracy, matters of criminal law, and was the face of European power in and around Canton.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a storehouse of knowledge and expertise, though not always accurate. Lots of hot takes by the East India Company on China, Chinese law, Chinese language, Chinese diplomacy, and the Qing Dynasty.
Okay.
Right, the Qing Empire, the power structure, all of that. And, you know, it's easy to think of it just as a company, but I mean, basically all the East India Company ships were armed. They had troops.
Yeah.
You know, they're over in India conquering things. They kind of have sort of an independent structure. And in some ways, it's sort of a meritocracy. Yeah. People work their way up to the top. You know, you don't get born a lord and then you get put in charge of the East India Company, right? So, and there is a lot of nepotism, but you know, it's
can't imagine that.
So while the East India Company was predatory, it was predatory in a predictable, negotiable way. So, you know.
You mean they're an organization.
They're an organization, okay. Right? They're a bad organization from...
They do harm.
Yes.
But do so in an organized way.
You can negotiate with them, and for the most part, they'll stick to the negotiation.
The agreements, okay.
Because they have a lot to lose.
Okay.
Right? They're a big organization. With its responsibility over essentially the entire British tea, silk, and porcelain trade, it took efforts to keep up good relations with Qing officials and the Hong merchants, who are the only people in Canton who can trade with the West, to follow their rules, crack down on fellow British troublemakers, and avoid overt dealings in opium. In fact, it was the British government, and particularly the Navy, that often got into more aggressive confrontations with the Qing, while the EIC recommended caution.
Mm, okay. So they're like, let's do business. Let's get rich.
Yeah. But so the East India Company is the one who does make basically all the opium.
Mm-hmm.
They make less and less as a percentage as time goes on because everybody else realizes that, wow, this is a big market.
Yeah.
So they're making it in Turkey. They're making it in places around India outside of EIC control.
Okay.
But, you know, they're kind of the starters of it. Opium has a long history in China, but, you know, they're the ones who kind of start this industrial mass production of it.
Okay.
But they're very quick to be hands-off with anything actually illegal, right? Because it's not illegal for them to make opium in India and sell it in India. And however it gets to China, that's not their problem.
They just turn a blind eye.
Yeah, they turn a blind eye.
We don't know where it's going.
Yes.
It's not our problem.
Up until this point, that's been good enough. Because as long as the opium... What was that?
You said that's been good enough. For whom?
For everyone.
Okay.
Because China hasn't really cracked down on it. It's illegal, but they don't do anything about it. But the East India Company takes pains to keep it out of their ships, to keep it out of Canton, to avoid any kind of incidents with the Qing officials.
Okay.
So it's happening off the coast. It's happening around Canton, like in the river, in the ports, or not on the port, but off the coast and stuff. They're smuggling ships. But the actual East India Company ships coming in, they're opium free.
Mm.
And the opium traders, there's a lot of them who are also British, they don't like them. They kind of view them as like thugs.
Okay.
Even though they're the ones kind of providing the drug. So it's kind of a complicated situation. But the East India Company is very risk averse. Now with them suddenly gone from the scene, a vacuum appears. Some of which is filled by traders already in Canton who had managed to work alongside the EIC, usually smuggling opium.
Okay.
So the EIC had the monopoly on trade from England, from the United Kingdom, to China. But opium came from India to China.
Mm-hmm.
So that was not the East India Company. That was other people.
Other people's ships, other people's...
Yeah, so that was smugglers.
Responsibilities,
all that
okay.
stuff. Many of these men were independent traders who had little to lose and much to gain by pushing the envelope of Qing patience. In their minds, the EIC had made fortunes for decades, and now it was time for them to make theirs.
Mm.
These people would trade in both. They would trade in opium, they would trade in regular stuff. Maybe they come and they sell the opium, and then they buy silk and tea and stuff, and they bring it back.
Okay.
Prior to this, you couldn't do that, really, because you were either all opium or you were all legit.
Right.
But now you can kind of intermingle the two. So this would be joined by a new class of British civil servants and military men with little or no knowledge of China, headed to Canton in order to take over the responsibilities once held by the EIC. It is to be noted that these drastic upheavals in the Canton trade process were made with little or no consulting with the Chinese, despite the efforts of the outgoing East India Company. The East India Company, they're like, hey, you know, the writing's on the wall, we're going to lose our mandate, but you got to figure something out with the Chinese officials, because they're not going to know what's going on.
Yeah.
Right? They're going to expect that they can come to us and tell us they have a problem and we'll fix it for them. So, you know, you have to figure out a new power structure. Also, the East India Company, you know, they have ships with guns, they have troops. So even though they're not, I guess, technically a military, you know, you have forces in Canton to kind of act as a threat, right? Which is now completely gone. Right now, basically, you just have regular trading ships that normally aren't really armed.
How did they lose their mandate? Why was this a sudden transition?
So it's complicated, but it has to do with British politics.
Okay.
Which I'm not an expert on. I'm not an expert on Chinese politics either, but that's never stopped me before.
Give me the general talking points.
Okay, so there was a change in how the representative government and the seats in the House of Commons were allocated. And previously, even though it's technically a democracy, there wasn't really like universal suffrage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of seats in the House of Commons that would go to areas with like 10 people in it. And you could just buy that area, essentially.
Okay.
And so it wasn't a very democratic or equal system. And the East India Company was seen as a product of that corrupt system because it's like there's no competition. They have a monopoly. Why do they still get to do this? And in a kind of a bid, like some people in Britain thought there was almost going to be a revolution, like the French Revolution, because people were so pissed off at the lack of representation.
Okay.
So there was all these upheavals in the UK around this time, and eventually it turned more into a kind of universal suffrage. Everybody gets the vote.
Okay.
No land holding requirements type deal.
So they voted for the East Indian Company not have a trade monopoly to China.
Yes, because it was seen as a, you know, like an anachronistic kind of special perk.
Okay. So you're saying, so nothing has changed on the Chinese side?
No, nothing has changed on the Chinese side. This is all, they're all at the mercy of the internal politics of the United Kingdom.
Okay.
So the East India Company gets the axe. Not only do they lose their mandate, but they're basically not even allowed to trade in China at all. So they're completely gone.
Okay.
And some East India officials stay on in kind of advisory roles, but more and more they kind of get filtered out. And now the people who are in China, who have the voice of this new parliament, are the opium smugglers. Some of which who have made so much money, they've come back and become lords
and
elected people in the House of Commons.
Right.
So it shifted like 180.
Okay.
And now like the drug dealers are the ones, you know, saying they're the China experts. Because the real China experts have all been kicked out.
Yes.
Okay.
So I don't know if they're the real Chinese experts.
Well, they are, right? Like, these are the people who, they wrote the first Chinese dictionary.
Okay.
You know, they
established.
George Stahn, we'll talk about, he went on both expeditions to meet the Chinese emperor. He met Qinlong. You know, it is the storehouse of knowledge.
They're the experts.
Like, they're not.
I'm convinced.
I'm not saying they're correct in their expertise.
Okay.
But they know more than basically anybody else.
In England.
In a position of power in England, right?
Okay.
So now, though, it's, you know, just essentially random people.
Okay.
That like the British government, it's almost like today in the US government where, you know, you donate a lot to a person's campaign and they're like, hey, my son would like to be the ambassador to Kenya.
Mm.
Yeah, whatever. Sure. I'm the president now. You know, you can be the ambassador to Kenya, right? Like that's.
Wait, is that how it works?
Yeah, that is how it works.
I had no idea.
More or less.
Yeah.
So the East India Company's like, no, this is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
Very bad timing. The UK is making all these changes at the same time the Qing is like, we got to get serious about opium. We got to get serious about the money situation.
Yeah.
And all that. So the most visible result of this was the creation of a new position, the Chief Superintendent of Trade. This is a very ambiguous position because the Qing denied both attempts to place an ambassador in Beijing, which we talked about one of them, which is the Macartney expedition.
Yeah.
The British asked for a lot more than just an ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was almost like they won a war.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted an island, they wanted all this stuff. But the problem is because the British don't have an ambassador, they don't really have any way officially of telling the Qing what's going on. This position is going to be less than ambassador. It's intended to promote the free flow of trade and report back to the government in London.
Okay.
The person who would do this before was like the head of the Canton Trade of the East India Company.
Okay.
But now the British government is appointing somebody there.
But they don't have ambassador status in China, so it's going to be a uphill battle for them to get that information?
It's going
to
be an uphill battle, and also they don't have any authority.
Yeah.
So this is going to sound complicated. And the irony is that, so the British view at least Parliament. They view China exactly as you'd view like Germany. Well, Germany didn't exist yet, but France, Italy. Well, Italy didn't exist, but an independent country, real independent country with rights.
Which it is.
Yes, it is.
But China don't see them that way.
Well, but the problem is you have British sailors breaking Chinese law.
Yes.
Right. Or breaking British law in China. So it is Canton. Is Chinese territory. It is it's Chinese land. So British laws don't apply there.
Mm-hmm.
Just like if we were visiting China, American laws don't necessarily apply there.
Right.
So British do not have the authority to arrest people on Chinese territory.
For breaking Chinese law.
For breaking Chinese law or for breaking British law.
Okay.
China has to do it.
Okay.
But China's not doing it.
Okay.
So they specifically tell these trade ambassador, you know, the chief superintendent of trade, like, you can't actually enforce any laws. You can't do anything because that's a breach of China's sovereignty, right? We can't act like we're police on Chinese territory.
Mm-hmm. So why is China not doing it?
Well, that's
say like a British person killed a Chinese person in Canton.
So that's a capital crime.
Okay.
They will punish that.
Okay. But if someone beats someone up.
If somebody beats somebody up or
someone trades opium,
smaller,
yeah,
then they typically won't.
Okay.
And basically they've said, they're like, well, these are Chinese laws. You guys don't know about them. You don't speak Chinese. You don't know our customs. So if it's a smaller thing, we'll just water under the bridge.
Mm.
We'll just ignore it and let trade keep flowing.
Okay.
But the problem with that attitude is that the British take advantage of it.
The individual British people.
Individual British people take advantage of it because they know exactly where they can push the line to.
Right.
Before it'll provoke a Chinese response,
mm.
which obviously makes things more and more tense.
Okay.
So they pick a superintendent of trade, send him to China. This guy's name is William John Napier, a Scottish lord and a Royal Navy veteran.
Okay.
So Napier ended up being a really bad choice, as he had basically no diplomatic experience. He's just kind of a guy who was in the Navy for a while, and then he was at his estate and didn't really have much to do. So they're like, hey, Napier, you want to go to China, be this new superintendent in trade? And he thought...
Was he a lord of some sort?
Yeah, he's like Lord Napier or something.
Okay.
And he immediately, this is almost like internet forums today, he gets in with the wrong crowd and he reads documents and opinions from like the opium smugglers. And the two most important names or the two most names that come up are these people called Jardine and Matheson.
Okay.
Who in, now in Hong Kong, one of the biggest companies is called Jardine Matheson and Co. Or it's, you know, it's so wonder where that company came from. I'll give you a guess.
Yes.
So they're like the, man, you know, China's a rotten house. You just kick the door in. We got to just go in there and.
So they're not the establishment. They're not the East Indian Company party.
No, they're the opium smuggler.
Okay.
Let's do whatever we want party.
Right.
And Napier's like, yeah, you know, these guys are right. I'm going to go there as the chief superintendent of trade, which really has no power.
Yeah.
And I'm going to treat it like a colonial possession.
Like I'm in India. Yeah. I'm going to insert my authority.
Yes.
So over these people that are mine.
Yes. So he looked back on British encounters with China over the preceding centuries, and he came to the conclusion that force always worked. He said, every act of violence on our part has been productive of instant redress and other beneficial results. So he's like, all we got to go and do is, you know, go in there, blow up a couple forts, burn some stuff down, and then we'll get whatever we want.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is that true, though?
Well, you're about to find out.
Okay. No, I mean, like, historically speaking, because he supposedly looked at what happened, right? He's like, every time we did this, we got something.
Not really. Hmm. I mean, so they didn't get anything from being nice. I guess they get everything.
The McCartney expedition failed.
Well, but they have been getting thousands, you know, all this money and revenue from tea, from silk, from porcelain. So they have gotten that from being nice. Something like 1/6 of the entire British Empire's revenue came from the China trade.
Taxing on the Chinese trade.
Yeah.
The Chinese imports.
Okay. And basically the conquest of India probably could not have happened without the money coming from the China tea trade, because the East India Company made the money from there.
Okay.
And then India is just a money sink to do it. And also, there's all sorts of standoffs that happen, and the British basically lose most of them.
Okay.
He had a fantasy of destroying China's sea forts, starting a propaganda campaign, and restoring a puppet Han Chinese dynasty to the throne. And he knew nothing really about China.
Yeah.
So, influenced by the most radical free traders, he quickly started a diplomatic standoff with the local imperial forces, posting inflammatory posters on the walls of foreign compounds, calling for the people of Canton to rebel. So what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to go to Macau, and you're supposed to say, hey, China, I'm the new trade representative from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to do whatever. Yeah. And then they say, yes, please come to Canton and we'll meet with you. Yeah. And when I say Canton, it's the Canton factories. Canton City, they're not allowed in. But
it's the general area.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they basically assume Napier is kind of the same thing as the chief of the East India Company trade in Canton. They give him a position called Taipan, which I guess is like...
They have no reason to...
Chief trader.
Suspect otherwise.
Yeah, they know it's a little different.
Right.
But, you know, they think, okay, we'll just kind of treat him the same.
Right.
But he just shows up in Canton, and he's like, hey, I'm here to talk with the Qing dynasty, you know, governor, the Qing emperor governor.
Mm.
And they're like, well, no.
That's not how it works.
Yeah. So basically, there's all these standoffs. There's people like standing outside the wall of Canton in their little British suits, waiting for 8 hours in the heat for, you know, the governor to see them.
Right.
And they just keep ignoring them. And yeah, he eventually basically starts calling for the people of Canton to rebel and kill the governor in Chinese posters.
I'm guessing that didn't work.
It didn't go over well.
Yeah.
So the governor general responded by halting all British trade, but not foreign or other foreign trade, banning Chinese from working with the British, and evicting them from Canton.
Right.
Napier refused and barricaded himself inside the British factory, calling his frigates, which eventually destroyed the local forts at the cost of several British dead and wounded. Though we don't know how many Chinese people died in the forts.
This really escalated really fast.
It escalated extremely quickly.
Yeah.
And this is all exactly...
Now it's a small war.
This is exactly what he's not supposed to do.
Right.
His job is to keep trade going.
Right.
And he immediately started a war.
I mean, I guess information flows slowly back in the days, right? He just goes and do this.
It takes a year. to get back to the UK, any information. So it's going to get shorter because of steamships.
Right.
But there's this thing with the trade winds, which I'm not an expert on, but the winds blow one way one part of the year and they blow the other part of the year.
Mm.
And when it's blowing the wrong way, you basically cannot get back to England.
And letters can't go back either.
Basically, no. Okay. So you got to time it and you got to do it.
Okay.
Once ships have steam, which is starting to happen at this period, you can go whenever. But right now, it's still
So the British Parliament or, I don't know, was it Queen Victoria at this time?
Not quite yet.
Okay.
I think she's right at this time period is like 1840 is when she starts.
Who's in charge?
Some King George or something or other. I forget.
Okay.
But really Parliament's in charge, right? Right.
But they have no way of stopping this.
No.
Even though...
They don't know what's
judging, assuming they're a reasonable government body,
no.
They would have said, maybe that's not a good idea.
No, they have no idea it's happening until it's already over.
Okay.
So...
I mean, if someone just comes in and calls for the local residents to rebel and kill the governor,
yeah.
Why would the governor be nice?
No, exactly.
Yeah.
And the governor puts up his own posters and says, like, actually, Napier, you're like a dog. And, like, you know, all that
like
stuff.
Like in Chinese?
I think you might have even... I mean, they speak English, right? Okay. I mean, they have English translators, so okay. It could be either way.
Okay, so really escalated, really blew up. Thanks, Napier.
Yeah. So the frigates blow up the forts.
Okay.
But then the governor sinks all these ships in the river and gets fireboats ready.
Okay.
So the frigates can't make it up to Canton.
Okay.
And also... there's the possibility that they won't be able to leave either because there's like, okay, they might sink ships behind us.
Right.
And then, you know, we're stuck in this river, the gunboats.
So things aren't looking so good for Napier.
Yes. With the trade still ended and no British gunboats coming, the more moderate British traders all politely suggested to Napier that he should leave. Like, why don't you just go back to Macau?
Yeah.
Right? And then we can start over. So eventually he broke down and left Canton, heading to Macau, where he died 2 weeks later, probably of malaria. And trade resumed as soon as he left. So that's a standoff. They used force, but the Qing Empire won, right? They won that standoff.
Right.
The appointment of Napier had been a disaster.
Yes.
And the British did not want to repeat their mistake. So right. There was a couple interim people who were old East India Company people. But there was another guy who had gotten sent with Napier, who was also a retired Navy officer. His name is Charles Elliot. His previous role was protector of slaves in British Guyana, a role which he attempted to prosecute slave owners for excessive cruelty. So prior to outlawing slavery, which is going to happen in, I think, 1833, right before he leaves, the British started to crack down on it, where they thought, like, okay, like, we need to... You know, you can't just do whatever you want to slaves. You can't just kill your own slaves. You can't whip them.
Yes.
And so they put Charles Elliot as protector of slaves in Guyana. I think it was in other places, too. You had this position. And slaves could go to them and basically report they were being abused, which obviously made him very popular among the local British there because, you know, he was putting them in...
You were being sarcastic.
Yes. Because he would fine them or put them in jail.
Right.
And then... he was brought back to England to help write the document to free slavery, to free slaves and end slavery, which I think passed.
To abolish slavery?
Abolish slavery. And crucially, one of the things they did in that document is they paid slave owners for their slaves. They reimbursed them.
Right, because it's their property and they're losing out on.
And also, I mean, I think it's just, morality aside, it makes it easier. It makes it easier for people to pass if, like, there's not a huge group of people who are upset that they're about to lose a bunch of money.
Yeah. Oh, you said morality.
Morality aside. Okay. Right?
Yeah.
He is basically, in a 1830s perspective, he's a good guy.
He was progressive for his time.
Yes. And I don't know if he's
That's terrible.
Progressive.
Yeah. Okay.
But he's not so racist that he can't do a job like this.
Okay.
He can see humanity in people that aren't white British people.
As people.
Yes, as people. So they thought, okay, well, Elliot, he's a stand-up guy. The British Prime Minister knew him.
Yeah.
So like, well, let's put him in charge, right? He's at least not going to start a war.
Oh, no.
with the Chinese.
I was hoping, because you said Napier had left.
Yeah.
Trade resumes. All the moderate merchants were like, let's just do this.
Yeah.
So I was like, then that should have just been a blip in history then.
Yeah.
But I guess no. That's not the case.
So the main issue seemed to be keeping the British traders in line, not dealing with any problems with the Qing. the Qing officials, the Hong merchants, they're all very stable. It's a very regulated system. Mm-hmm. There's not really any surprises there. So they're not the problem. His own people are the problem.
Okay. These barbarians.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he needs to keep them from provoking an issue with the Qing.
Right. But I thought he has no authority of law enforcement.
He has no authority. He's asked for authority, but he doesn't get it. For example, at one point, he's like, okay, I'm going to start a little force of off-duty sailors who are going to, like, you know, if somebody gets drunk and starts fight with Chinese, you know, they'll grab, you know, like basic order keeping stuff around the Canton factories.
Yeah.
And then when the prime minister finds out, who's this guy called Palmerston, he's like, no, you can't do that. You can't organize a militia on Chinese territory, right? Like, what if they stop the trade? So you have to stop it, right? So he basically has zero authority.
Right.
What?
In the Bacarni episode, we talked about how they were, their own soldier, the one British soldier, I think got drunk or something.
Yeah.
And they were whipping him.
Yes.
In front of the Chinese people.
Yes.
Outside the palace.
Yeah.
In Beijing.
Well, that's military discipline.
Okay.
Which is different. These are all independent, free British citizens.
Right. I guess they're not like enlisted soldiers. They're merchants. Yes. They're business people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is a problem. Since there are those among the British traders who had almost no regard for Chinese law, outside, which actually at this point, the British knew what Chinese law was because they translated the Qing legal codes.
They just don't care.
Yes.
It's a libertarian's dream.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's a complete, basically a power vacuum.
Yeah.
Outside of capital crimes like murder, the Chinese were loath to try and prosecute foreigners for crimes.
Okay.
Charles Elliot and the more moderate traders were worried at some point this Chinese patience would run out and a confrontation would develop. Thus, the British needed to keep their own traders in check, as the East India Company once did. Still, he was off to a better start than Napier. He obeyed all the proper protocols, and being recognized by Deng Qingzheng, the governor of general of... Am I saying it wrong? Qingzheng?
Qingzheng? don't mind me.
Okay. The Governor General of Canton, he was given a Chinese name that translated to righteous law and given the title of Lingxi, or consul.
Aww.
Napier was given a name that translated to barbarian eye, so it gives you an idea of what they thought of the two people.
Yeah.
However, like his protector of slave role, the real problem was, again, the other British, and Elliot attempted in vain to keep British traders from intermingling opium with the regular trade.
Mm.
More and more merchants would be involved in both, as would the Hong merchants who controlled the Canton trade.
Mm.
So some of the actual, like, of the 10 merchants you could trade with, some of them would now trade opium too.
Right.
Legalizing opium, he believed, would solve many of his problems and cut down on many of the possible flashpoints with China.
Well, best luck to him to convince the Chinese government to do that.
Yeah. And so one of the reasons actually this also exploded, beyond one of the other things that happened, is the East India Company lost its mandate, which meant anybody could go to China and trade tea.
Yeah.
Which means way more tea and silk and stuff went to the UK.
Okay.
Which drove the prices down. But it also meant, you know, more trade, which means you need more silver, which means you need more opium.
Yeah.
To make
There's
up the
There's a bigger trade imbalance.
Yes.
Yeah.
The opium market had become flooded with supply as producers, markets, merchants, and speculators all bet on legalization and a massive new market.
Mm.
However, within the Qing court, the matter had already been decided. So at this point, right, you have huge increase in the amount of opium. Opium is going everywhere.
Yeah.
They've basically decided, these traders have decided internally, like, oh, well, the Qing don't care. Yeah, it's illegal, but they don't enforce it. So why do we need to worry about it?
Yeah.
So, at the order of the emperor in 1837, Deng Qingzheng took massive... Deng?
I don't... It's fine.
It just struggles, like, with foreign barbarians.
I'm trying to make you learn Chinese. It's fine. I'm glad you are trying. You don't have to prove anything.
Okay, you can patronize me and tell me I did a good job.
I'm not patronizing, I'm just saying.
Tell me I did a good job pronouncing it. Okay, so, but the governor general, in 1837, the emperor is like, no, we're gonna ban it. We're gonna keep banning it, but we're gonna actually enforce it now.
Okay.
So legalization's off the table. So the governor general of Canton took massive steps to cut down on the opium trade. This was extremely effective, given how industrialized the trade had become.
Mm.
Smuggling ships were chased, dealers and transporters arrested, and smokers punished. So ironically, because it had become more intermingled in Canton, and it had become more standardized, it was easier to crack down on. It was a little bit harder before when people were kind of doing it out on the coast. And,
right.
But he left foreigners alone. He's just basically like, if you deal with it, you know, you're going to get killed or punished or whatever. If you're an opium den, you're going to get trouble. If you transport it.
So they're punishing the Chinese people.
They're punishing the Chinese people.
Okay. So they're punishing the buyer's market.
Yeah. They're punishing the buyer's market.
Yeah.
You know?
And the idea is that if you punish any Chinese person who deals with opium or comes in contact with it,
yeah,
there will be no market for it, so that it will just die down.
But the problem is,
yeah,
is that this filled Canton with increasingly agitated and desperate opium traders, eager to find a market for their cargoes. Because the opium market, like today, a lot of markets, it's all based on futures and loans and all these things. So it's not like you just buy the opium. Right?
Yeah.
So like a lot of these merchants, they don't even own the opium in their ship.
Right.
It's like on consignment or there's a loan. So there's all this money and all this debt in it. So it's not like they can just stop. They have to sell their cargo.
Well, they could eat the cost, but they're not going to.
Well, I mean, they, you know.
Or they
I mean?
Go bankrupt.
Which, yeah. You know, what's a little drug dealing between you and bankruptcy? So.
Yeah. These are not Chinese people. If the government cracks down on something, they'll just, that'll be it. Yeah. Okay.
So there was requests to Elliot from the Hong traders to cut down on the trade. Because they're like, okay, there's all these ships. Because it's interesting. So the Hong traders technically are part of the Qing Empire. But in a way, they have a much more chummy relationship with the foreigners. You know, they'll kind of tell them stuff on the side that they're not supposed to know. And they're like, hey, you guys have all these ships in around Canton in the harbor. Full of opium, and it's going to cause a problem. So you kind of need to get it out of here.
Right. He should listen to them.
Well, so Elliot was like, okay,
I'm
going to tell the people they can't bring opium into Canton.
Yeah.
Or into the Canton area. But they just ignore him because he doesn't have the power.
He has no authority.
He has no authority.
Yeah.
In fact, Palmerston, the British Prime Minister, has explicitly told Elliot that any punishment or loss endured by opium traders, quote, must be borne by the parties who have brought that loss upon themselves by their own acts. If anything happens to people because they're trading opium, just let it happen. It's not our fault. But I think
China can prosecute them.
China can prosecute them,
right.
Whatever. But I think what he didn't realize, Palmerston, is just how much opium was there and just how many people were involved with it. Because it's basically like a huge percentage of the people at least deal a little opium.
You know, so it's in almost every trading ship, cargo.
Yeah, maybe not every ship, but almost every company deals with it a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
So there was an attempt to pass the resolution to give Elliot's position some teeth, but it failed. This is in British Parliament. But it failed due to fears it would anger China by impinging on their sovereignty. It did.
Has anyone talked to China about this at this point? Has anyone said we want...
Well, who do you talk to?
The Canton governor?
I mean, you can't talk to the Canton governor, right? I mean, you're not... an ambassador, right? I mean, you're just a...
I thought they gave him a name that's like a...
I know, but it's all
so
very
some
like...
some sort of communication going on.
It's all
on.
Very official, right? I mean, and the people in Canton are like, Elliot, you got to get this under control.
Yeah.
Without an agreement from the Chinese government, the Qing Empire, saying like, yes, you can do this, the British Parliament's like, well, we can't do it, right? Just because some guy told you... you should do it. That's not a legal agreement between two countries.
Okay.
Since there was no official diplomatic relationship with China, they were at an impasse. Yeah. So interestingly, Chinese merchants knew they could not control the British and were eager for the bill to pass. Ironically, out of respect for Chinese authority, the bill failed.
Right.
Things had already progressed beyond that point, though, from an official Chinese perspective. They were determined to stamp out the opium trade from their side and assert the primacy of Chinese law. Okay. So... the man chosen to do it. The man, the myth, the legend. Lin Zexu. How would you pronounce
good
it?
Good job.
Did I do a good job?
Yeah.
Okay.
Lin Zexu.
This is, you know, the thing that probably is in every Chinese school kid learns in elementary school.
Every textbook.
Every textbook. History, yeah. There's a bunch of statues of him all over the place. He's the guy. He's the hero.
He's the Chinese hero in the story.
He's the former governor of Hunan and Hubei. He passed the imperial examination, which is the highest level, at the age of 26. Famed for his honesty, hard work, and lack of corruption, he was seen as one of the most capable ministers in China. So he's, you know, favorite of the emperor. He's seen as a guy who can get stuff done.
I mean, he did.
Yeah. Well, he, yeah.
Spoilers alert.
Spoiler alert. Yeah. He got some stuff done.
Yeah.
In 1838, he enacted opium control measures in his own provinces, confiscating opium, arresting dealers, treating addicts, and sending reports to the emperor of his progress.
Okay.
Later that year, he was summoned to the capital and tasked with ending the flow of opium inward from Canton, presiding over all local officials with the power of the emperor himself.
Mm.
Things escalated quickly. In late 1838, opium was confiscated inside the Canton factories themselves. There was a ship that was offloading some stuff on the docks, going to like one of the legations, I forget which one, the factory buildings. And it got stopped and they searched it and it was full of opium. And they're like, well, where was this going? And they're like, oh, it's, you know, it's going to the factory. So this...
When you say factory, you mean like a storage house?
They're... I don't know what the word, what they called them in Chinese, but it's basically like a combination of apartment building and business offices.
Okay.
So they have some storage, but not a lot.
Okay.
It's really... You do the deal there.
Okay.
And then the Chinese ships meet the British ships in the harbor, and they move the tea across, or they do whatever.
Okay.
So this is just where the deals are made, essentially.
Okay.
In order to send a message, the governor general, Deng Tingzhen, ordered the execution of an opium dealer outside the British factory. They're like, okay, well, we're going to show the British the chaos they're causing inland. They tied a guy to a cross, and they did a thing where you strangle the person.
Okay.
I think it's in... very relatively common execution technique in this period in China.
Okay.
Put a rope across their neck and you twist it and then they choke. But they do this right outside the windows, which normally I think at the British factory.
Okay.
The British and the Americans, I think too, try and stop it because, you know, I don't know. They don't like it.
The official stance of the British though, the British government.
Yeah. They have no authority to try and stop it.
Yeah, wasn't there like, just let them execute
it? Yeah, just let them execute it.
Yeah.
So the British tried to interfere, but then a riot began as the local Chinese in Canton, who basically hated a lot of the British because they would be, you know, they're very arrogant and mean, and besieged them inside their buildings. You know, they're like throwing rocks and stuff. Eventually, Chinese soldiers interfered and halted the riot and things calmed down.
Mm.
Palmerston, the British Prime Minister, when he heard this happen, reiterated that Elliot should not interfere with Chinese law. He's like, if they want to execute people, just let them execute people. Mm. Obviously, Elliot has no authority to stop people from interfering with an execution, right? I mean, if people are going to go out...
He can't stop the execution. He can't stop people being his own people being unhappy about the execution either.
All he can really do is watch.
Right.
So Elliot did little he could and threatened, and he said, okay, well, I can't stop you from bringing opium into the harbor. But if I hear of any ship or, you know, I find out of any ship with opium, I'm going to turn you over to the Chinese authorities.
And they're going to hang you.
And they're going to hang you, right? And he wrote to Deng, the governor general, in support of his opium crackdown.
Mm.
Elliot's like, I'm with you, bro. You know, I don't like this either. Elliot was anti-opium.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Where did it turn?
This didn't go over well with the opium traders, and they basically ignored him.
Okay.
Still, it had some effect. The largest American firm involved in the opium trade, Russell & Co., publicly exited the opium trade soon after.
Mm.
And some other traders kind of was like...
If the British government is not standing behind it...
Yeah, they're like, this is getting a little hot for my blood.
But the British merchants are still there. They're not giving up.
No, right? Okay. I mean, a lot of the big ones, you know, they make so much money off of this.
Mm.
But Lin Zexu hasn't even arrived yet. So he arrives in March 1839, and having consulted with various scholars and officials during his journey on the best way to proceed. So on his way to Canton, he stopped with all these, you know, high up scholars and thinkers, and, you know, kind of like a think tank. You know, like, what should we do about these foreigners, right? Right. And we talked about some of this in the previous episode, right? Some people are like, oh, you should just ban the trade and all that.
Yeah.
Eventually, he decided, okay, we're going to have two strategies. We're going to punish all officials and merchants involved in the trade, and we're going to halt the imports of the drug.
Mm.
So the users of the drug would fade away naturally once the supply is gone. So he kind of is a different tactic. He's not necessarily going after the end users. He's now thinking like, we got to go after the source, which is the British and corrupt officials. So he went into action as soon as he arrived, arresting dealers, confiscating pipes and opium, and otherwise intensified Deng's already severe crackdown. Then on March 18th, he gave British merchants 3 days to hand over all their opium. When there was no response, he locked down the factories the next day, not allowing the foreigners to leave.
Mm.
Marching the Hong merchants outside the compounds in chains, he arrested they would be executed if the opium was not delivered. Mm-hmm. And the Hong merchants are the people that these traders deal with,
yep,
like every day. So they know them. They like
them.
They're
business partners.
Yeah. So they're like, well, who do we know who's Chinese that we can execute that they'll care about? So they're like, we're going to kill these guys. But the British traders just kind of ignore it. Now, at this
so far for the friendship between them.
Yes. So at this point, though, this is not the first time this has happened. This basically happened with Napier. It happened again in the 1830s when they were sneaking their wives over.
Mm.
From time to time, the Chinese forces would throw their weight around,
right,
halt trade, lock things down, take all the Chinese servants away, and kind of try and play hardball. And the more senior British merchants had seen this before, right? So they're just like, whatever, we're going to eat canned food for a while. Mm-hmm. We'll see how this goes.
Yeah.
They're not thinking we're all going to get executed. So some underhanded discussions were made between the Hong merchants and the opium dealers. The Hong merchants are like, look, Lin Zexu doesn't know how much opium you have. If you give him a lot, let's say a couple thousand chests. So a chest of opium is like 65 kilograms.
Okay.
So if you give him a couple thousand, we'll pay you back on the sly.
Right.
This whole thing can be over.
Right.
So, because first they're like, we'll give you like 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And Lin Zexu's like, no, I know you have more opium than that.
Right.
So they're like, maybe we can give him like
4,000. You have to give him enough to be believable.
Yeah. Okay. So Lin Zexu's like, maybe we can give him like 4,000. So they're kind of thinking like, okay, maybe we can kind of do some sort of deal and this will all be over.
Right.
But then Charles Elliot arrives from Macau. Charles Elliot, again, doesn't really have any experience with China. I mean, he has some now because he's been there a couple of years.
Okay.
But as far as I know, he doesn't speak Chinese. He doesn't know
that
much.
He's not well-versed in the Chinese of doing things.
And this is his first actual crisis.
Okay.
Which the East India Company, for example, had been through many.
Mm.
So he arrives. He arrives in his military uniform with his sword, feeling
very good about himself. Feeling very
important.
Okay.
He arrives on the 24th, which is, I think, like 6 days after this starts. And he took stock of the situation.
Okay.
Believing there was a serious risk of the British traders being imprisoned or killed, he decided to take matters into his own hands.
Well, I thought it's okay that they get killed or...
I know, but...
But I guess it's not okay.
He wants
then
to be the hero.
It's just all... Yeah, okay.
So he's thinking like, I gotta do something.
Mm.
So though he had no authority to do so, Elliot ordered all merchants to hand over their opium to Lin. And if they did so, the British government would reimburse them for its value. Since the recent crackdowns had created an oversupply, the merchants leapt at this chance to unload their cargoes.
Yeah.
This came to a sum of 20,283 trusts.
Okay.
Worth £2 million, which is a lot of money.
So far, I'm just hearing that the merchants aren't really going to lose money.
No.
The Chinese are going to pay them. Yeah. The Chinese merchants are going to pay them. The British government is going to reimburse them.
Yeah. So they're like, oh, great. Yeah, sure. You can have our opium, Elliot.
Yeah.
Because, they already have too much.
Yeah.
They're thinking like, who knows when Lin Zexu is going to end.
Yeah, let's just get rid of it.
Let's just get rid of it. Yeah, get paid and, move on.
Yeah.
So.
Then what's the problem?
And people think that Elliot got this idea because that's what they did with slavery. They just, they paid the people for the slaves and then they're like, okay, let's move on. So he thought, okay, we'll do this, and then, it'll be over. So a chest of opium is roughly 65 kilograms, so it came out to 1.3 million kilograms,
mm-hmm,
or 55 20-foot shipping containers of opium, or 2019.
Let me guess, this is going to become too expensive for the British government?
Yeah. So, or 1,000...
He didn't do his math?
1,015 2019 Honda Civics weight of opium. So this is, if you think about sailing ships... And people physically moving crates and chests around.
Right.
This is an insane amount of opium.
Mm.
Most opium seizures were for a few chests, the highest never breaching 1,000.
Mm.
This was more opium than had likely ever been captured total in all of this entire crackdown by far.
Mm. Okay.
So if Lin was shocked by this number, he played it cool. And he's like, yeah, give me the opium.
Yeah.
And after a brief back and forth with the emperor, he decided to destroy it in Canton because they thought, it's too much complication to transport it to Beijing.
Yeah, let's just burn it all here.
We'll burn it all here, and we have to destroy it because otherwise people will think we smoked it.
Yeah.
We smoked a million kilograms of opium.
Yeah.
His letter asked the emperor to show benevolence to the foreigners, for they had so swiftly capitulated, and perhaps give them a little gift in exchange. Maybe give them a little tea, so they would have something to trade with now that they lost all their opium.
Okay.
You know? So he refused to let the foreigners leave, though, until three-fourths of the promised opium had arrived.
Mm.
He also demanded they all sign an affidavit, you know, it's called a bond, agreeing to never trade opium again under penalty of death. This infuriated Charles Eliot, who felt he had already done his utmost to defuse the crisis. So Charles Eliot thought, we'll agree to do the opium, they'll let us go, things will go back to normal, we'll get them the opium.
Hmm.
And Lin Zexu's like, no. When I get all of the opium, and I better get all the opium you promised me.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually turns out that they didn't have 20,000 chests, like,
they overpromised?
Well, some people like inflated their amount of opium because they're like, oh, I'm going to get a payout, right? So they're like, it was kind of like, and apparently near the end, they were like, they were like taking chests and kind of spreading the opium around them.
Okay.
And Charles Eliot was even having to buy new opium that was coming in from India to get the right amount.
Okay.
So Lin Zexu was playing hardball.
Right.
And this really pissed off Charles Eliot because this went on for like 2 months where they're basically trapped there.
Mm.
And so to him,
I thought we had a deal. He's like, it's fine.
I did everything I could
to
get you your opium.
Yeah, you got to meet me halfway.
That was from his perspective. So there's a lot of letters back and forth, which I read in the correspondence that were translated.
Mm-hmm.
And Lin's like, no, you got to sign this bond. You got to say you won't trade opium. And Elliot's like, well, I can't sign it. I don't have the authority, but I'm not going to sign a document that says it's okay to kill us if we trade opium.
Didn't he want every merchant to sign their own copy, or did he wanted Charles Eliot to sign one copy?
I think he wanted them all to sign it, but it's like collective punishment.
Mm.
If Eliot signs it, then they can go,
they've signed it.
Well, it's okay to kill you.
Yeah.
Your government said so.
Yeah.
So Eliot's like, no, I can't.
Which technically their government did say so, if I
heard
you right,
but
many times.
But it's different saying.
Maybe they didn't mean it.
Well, it's different. I mean, I don't think they really meant it, but it's different saying, well, Chinese law will do whatever.
Yeah.
It's another thing to sign a document saying we agree with Chinese law and it's okay to punish us under Chinese law.
I mean.
Well, okay. So this is one of.
It's not just my education. I mean, am I getting ahead?
No.
Okay. It's not just my education of like the whole, 100 years of shame thing.
Yeah.
But I do think the British sounds like they want to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And they're used to, they were in India and they were doing whatever they want.
Yeah.
So like they just want to do that in China too.
Yeah.
But they also want the appearance because China is not officially a colony.
Yeah.
It's not a colony, right? But
yes.
But they want the appearance of they're doing things on the up and up, but they don't really mean it. They don't really want to take responsibility.
No, they don't.
They're not ready to sacrifice the
no. And when
the,
push the comes merchants. And when push comes to shove,
yeah,
which we'll see shortly.
Yeah,
they're gonna just go like, well, I guess we'll just torch the place.
Yeah, no, right. So,
so this is one of letters from Lin to Charles Eliot explaining why you should just sign this bond.
Mm.
So Lin says. And this is translated. And there's lots of back and forth. Like every day, Charles Eliot's like, can we leave? And Lin's like, no.
No.
So after my arrival in Canton, I immediately proclaimed to all the foreigners that as their past dealings in opium might have been in ignorance of the severe prohibitions of the celestial court, these, their past faults, should now be indulgently remitted. And they should merely be required to take the opium on board their storeships and surrender the whole amount to the government.
Mm.
And to give full and voluntary bonds, declaring plainly that vessels shall henceforth come with no opium, or if any do so, that the merchandise shall be confiscated and the parties executed.
Mm.
In consequence of this, the foreigners of all nations addressed me. Although they expressed their readiness to pay obedience, their bonds were not, however, presented. They're like, which he means is like, everyone said they're not going to do opium, but they're not actually going to sign a paper saying we're not going to do opium.
When he says all foreigners, do you mean British officials? The British nationals?
Well, I mean, there's other people. There's free Indian traders. Mm. Like, there's...
So he speaks for all of them? All of them are telling him to not sign this because that might set a precedent?
Well, no one's signing it, right? Americans aren't signing it.
Well, Americans has already left, supposedly.
No, the Americans are there too. Everybody gets locked down.
Oh, okay.
It's just
I thought they stopped trading. Okay.
the British are the most numerous.
Okay.
So they're kind of leading the negotiations, mm. but everybody got locked down. He did not, Lin Zexu was not like everybody else can go, the British has to stay.
Right.
Because but, so everyone's trading opium.
Was he supposed
opium.
To sign a thing that every foreigner gets executed?
I
was
mean,
he signing for the Great Britain, or was he signing for
it's a little
all
unclear.
White people? Or
I'm sure if Eliot signed a paper saying all foreigners will do this, mm. Lin Zexu would have taken it.
Oh yeah,
and said yeah right. at that time, being engaged in requiring to deliver the opium, mm-hmm. I had not opportunity at once to urge the execution of the bonds, and I thought that as the said foreigners ordinarily pay regard to the word. Good faith, mm. because this is what Charles Eliot's saying, like, oh, come on, I'll give you the opium. Like, let us go on good faith.
Yeah.
He's like, they would, since they were willing to deliver up the opium, execute the bonds also without any need of urging. Who would have expected on the part of the said superintendent a continued procrastination and delay, mm. or that he would now have presented an address making pretext to evade and excuse himself from the matter? As regards... such vessels as may arrive here in two quarters of the spring and summer now current, they will have left their countries while yet ignorant of the existing investigations and the severe enforcement of prohibitions. Mm. Such of them as, in this state of ignorance, bring any opium, shall surrender it as they arrive, not daring to secrete. So basically he's saying like, look, I'm not unreasonable. People come in like the next year, they just have to surrender their opium. We won't kill them. Mm. But by, you know, a year, everybody should know. And after that, we're going to start killing people, mm. which is, you know, that's reasonable on Lin Zexu's part, right? He's saying like, mm-hmm. you know, they're not going to know. They don't know in England that yeah. we just did this. So it's yeah. okay. I'm not a monster.
Yeah.
Charles Eliot, however, was not
happy. Did not see eye to eye to that
no.
solution. Okay.
And he wrote a series of extremely angry letters to Palmerston, the British prime minister. And he's basically like, you got to send troops here and you got to get us out. like, He's like.
Wait, what happened to no interference?
Yeah. Yeah. He's like. These Chinese people are crazy.
Was he just told by Palmer that it's fine?
I know, but okay. But like Palmerston's finding out all this one step at a time.
Right.
So Palmerston finds out. You know, Eliot writes a letter. I'm gonna buy the opium.
Right.
Palmerston's like, oh my god. And then 2 days later, or a week later, Palmerston gets another letter saying like, we're still locked out. You gotta send some guys to break
right.
us out.
Well, then do letters go through the
ships, yeah.
The ocean much more quickly
so it's
now?
It's a year later.
Okay.
But I mean, like, you still need a year then to respond back,
okay.
right?
Okay.
Or maybe it's 6 months, because okay. it's 6 months there and 6 months back.
All right.
So...
But Palmer has no direct influence of what's happening
no.
in
he
Canton
can do,
because it's 6 months later.
Yes. And the East India Company's there, so they don't have any warships there either, really.
Right.
So the only thing he can really decide to do is, like, do we send in the gunboats or not?
Right.
And that's going to be another 6 months
right.
down the line. So Lin would not let the British traders leave for over 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
But not long after they reached Macau, a new crisis struck. A group of British sailors were drinking and allegedly killed a Chinese villager in a fight.
Since
trade was already shut down, mm-hmm. Eliot refused to hand this guy over to Chinese authorities, the sailor he thinks... had did it, or at least the sailor that the Chinese said had did it.
Mm.
So the Chinese are like, it was this guy. That's the guy who killed, you know, whoever. And Eliot's like, well, I don't know. So
he can't have him. Why? Because
So previously when this had happened, there was like there's a thing called signal guns where you shoot off the cannons, like in celebration or recognition of someone. You don't put a bullet in there. You don't put a cannonball in the cannon.
Yeah. It's not just in celebration. Sometimes it's for
all sorts of
denouncing
stuff.
Shame.
Signals
denouncing
or
shame, yeah.
whatever. Mm-hmm. So the British did one and they accidentally loaded a cannonball and they like blew apart a fisherman.
Oh, God. Okay.
And this was like years ago.
Okay. But they think it was an accident.
Well, and the Chinese are like, you got to turn the guy over who shot the cannon.
Yeah.
And they did. And the Chinese executed him.
Okay.
So that's basically like the precedent was set. Like the Chinese do not enforce minor crimes, but if you commit a capital crime.
Yeah.
You're done
yeah.
if you get to China.
Yeah.
So they're like, no, we're not going to give him over. Because Eliot's in a very belligerent mood right now.
He's just mad.
He's mad.
He's like, old rules no longer
yes.
apply here.
So
okay.
So at this point then, Lin Zexu's like, oh, you want to play hardball?
Mm.
So
I can play hardball.
He massed troops outside of Macau.
Right.
And he's like, you know, I can take over Macau too.
Mm-hmm.
And there was rumors that they like poisoned the water. So now the British are like this little flotilla out at sea. But they can't land anywhere. Eventually, they kind of go into Macau Harbor, and they're having to, like, get in gunfights with the locals to get water because Lin Zuxu says, like, if you give the foreigners food or let them have water, we're going to burn down your village. So, you know, it's a very tense situation.
Right.
Meanwhile, Lin Zuxu is having the time of his life over there burning, you know, getting rid of all the opium.
Yeah.
Feeling like, I really did
this
it.
This is great.
This is great.
I really did a thing.
I really did a thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, by all means, he was tasked with this thing.
And the emperor said...
It seemed to me that he was very competent in resolving...
Yeah. The emperor said...
In achieving the goal that he was told...
By the emperor to
achieve.
Do.
Yeah.
No, the emperor's like, get it done. Stop the trade.
Yeah.
Trade stopped.
Yeah.
No more opium.
Yeah.
Back to parliament. They were blindsided by Elliot's promise of compensation for the opium.
Yeah.
But as we discussed, there was a precedence with the whole slavery situation.
Mm.
However, while slavery had been a large, somewhat distributed problem, the opium trade was a high-value enterprise by a relatively small group of men.
Mm. So they're bailing out...
Like the rich banks,
the
right?
The rich banks, yeah.
So there's this
And that might not have the support,
yeah.
Like, across the board.
There's this issue. It's kind of the Caribbean and all these slave plantations were not very hospitable to, I mean, anyone, because slaves died a lot too, but also to British people. They die of disease all the time. So there's all these, there's this whole population of orphans and widows in England who on paper own slave plantations in the Caribbean because their husbands had gone there.
So everyone is it's a happier situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they like, but opium doesn't have that situation.
Mm-mm.
You know what I mean? It's not that many companies. It's not that many people.
Yeah.
And while there would be fallout, there's a lot of people who are just saying like, just let it happen.
Yeah. We don't care.
Yeah. So if they were to get the funds from China, because that's what Elliot was saying. He's like, just come over here and get the money back. Basically, come over here and have a shakedown.
Mm.
But there was no guarantee a military expedition to China would be quick and painless. They knew that obviously...
Usually it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The British government, the British military was more technologically advanced, was more powerful than the Chinese military. They knew that. But the Qing court could just ignore them. And then like, what are they going to do? They can wander all over and burn down villages and do stuff. But like... Mm-hmm. If the Qing government never deals with you, then it's going to go on forever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you won't get your silver.
Yes. So beyond that, it would be a terrible look to send troops in order to support the opium trade. British liberals came out against it, as did religious figures and reformists, drawing similarities to it and gin, because they were like, oh, opium is like the Chinese gin, because... alcohol production had become industrialized during this time.
Mm.
Before it was like, it was beer, which is, you know, a more wholesome thing. But now you're pumping out millions and millions of gallons of like cheap, just like industrial booze, right? And it's causing all sorts of problem in England. And they're like, you know, this is all just big business poisoning people.
Okay.
And already before it was even agreed on, they were calling it the Opium War. So Parliament was extremely sharply divided on the issue of the Opium War, the possible upcoming Opium War. And a vote of censure, basically like a vote of no confidence, was brought against Palmerston's government on the issue of damaging the British Empire's relationship with China, a relationship that brought in roughly 1/6 of the entire British Empire's revenue.
Right.
Specifically for not giving Charles Elliot the powers he asked for, which might have kept the opium traders in check and stopped this before it started.
China might have been okay with it.
Well, I mean, yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have even have known, right?
Right.
I mean, so like basically they're like, you should have given it. Charles Elliot's a good guy. He said he needed this. You ignored all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're in this situation.
Mm.
So enter George Staunton, a minor member of the House of Commons.
Okay.
And definitely the one with the strongest knowledge of China. He had been on both diplomatic expeditions to the Qing court, and he was the child who received the gift personally from Emperor Qinlong for his Chinese. We talked about this in the McCartney expedition.
Yeah.
So
he's an old friend of the Chinese people.
He is probably at this point the greatest like living expert.
Okay. Of
right?
China.
Yes.
Okay.
He had worked in Canton in the East India Company for decades.
Mm.
He spoke fluent Chinese. He had translated the Qing legal codes and was the first Westerner to argue law in a Qing court.
Mm.
And basically what happened was, I think I remember this correctly, but there was a brawl or something happened and a Chinese guy got put in a coma. They wanted to execute like the British sailor or whatever. Staunton argued the guy died, the Chinese guy died after like 50 days.
Mm.
And I guess the Qing law is like, if somebody dies within 40 days of a fight, that's murder. But if it's past that, it's like, well, you can't prove it. What's the fight? Maybe he just died on his own.
Yeah.
And so he got off. He got the guy off.
Okay.
Right. And this was the first time anyone, you know, he acted as a lawyer and actually engaged in the Chinese court.
And succeeded.
He was strongly against the opium trade. His only previous parliamentary speech to date had been in 1833 on the disastrous results of disbanding the East India Company charter without Chinese input, and also the power vacuum that would result unless some other framework was put in place to control British traders. No one had listened to him then, but now in 1840, his words seemed incredibly prophetic.
He's like, I told you so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now in his speech, George Staunton, the expert, did his best to convince a rapt audience that for the sake of the British Empire's relationship to China, it must send a military force and make war upon the Qing Empire.
Oh, no.
To summarize his views, because, I mean, you would think he'd be the guy who's like, no, we can negotiate with these people, right?
Right.
He said, historically, there had always been provocations on both sides. But Lin's unilateral decision to place foreign traders under Chinese law without discussion or warning was an incredible escalation that could not go unanswered. If the Qing Empire treated the British like inferiors and the British accepted it, then they would continue to treat them as inferiors. In some ways, the quick capitulation of Charles Elliot only made Lin Zexu more bold. The British Empire must show itself to be an equal, not a supplicant.
Yeah.
We have to be tough.
Yes.
And this is outside of any morality, you know, of who's right.
Yeah.
Now, I want to go on a brief little tangent here. So we talked about on the McCartney expedition, but the big hot button thing on every diplomatic interaction with China has been the kowtow. Right?
Yeah.
And it's like, are they going to do the kowtow? Should we do the kowtow?
Yeah.
And interestingly, Staunton, on his second expedition, where he was basically like very high up in it, told the British ambassador or the British, you know, envoy, do not kowtow. Under any circumstances, do not do it. And the other people and the other Chinese experts agreed. But most British people who didn't know anything about China were like, or like Napier, the guy at the beginning who wanted to start a war with China, was like, yeah, whatever, I'll do the kowtow. I don't care.
See it as a representation of the British Empire showing its weakness.
It's like, it's just some stupid thing.
Yeah.
But Staunton's like, no, it's real and they're going to treat it as seriously. And if we show the Chinese government that we can be constrained by Chinese laws and Chinese power, they are going to treat us like there is no concept in Chinese diplomacy of an equal.
Yeah.
You only come as an inferior, a supplicant.
You're like the Korea or the Japan.
Yes,
like,
right.
Or the Japanese, you know, like you only come in and tribute, you know, a bunch of gifts to the emperor to show your loyalness.
Yes.
And you're a vassal state of some sort.
And he's basically...
they will leave you alone.
Yeah.
But like, you are inferior.
Yeah, and he basically said, like, you know, he's like, well, we've basically gotten around it by now by just not really testing the waters. The Chinese say they're superior, but they know they can't really get us to do what they want. And we just don't push it and kind of just keep the status quo. And
but now's the time.
Yeah.
Now's the time to show some teeth.
Yeah, because now the government, Lin Zexu, is treating us like a subject, like a tributary. Like, you don't have to tell Japan.
I mean, technically...
Well, I mean,
they are on Chinese soil.
I know. But he's like saying, like, you know, they're just saying that they just think, oh, we can alter the deal and you just have to accept it.
Right.
No, we cannot let them do that because then they're going to alter the deal whenever they want.
Yeah.
So.
Also, I mean, England is, I mean, they're used to getting their way everywhere else in the whole world.
Yeah.
There's no other place. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Well, but.
Okay. And he says, basically, he's like, the fact that Elliot has kowtowed to Lin by giving him what he wants means that
has
now
caused this.
Yeah, we need a show of force to right the balance and show we're not a tributary. Otherwise, the relationship with China would become more and more strained, and the ripple effects of this loss of prestige may even damage other British colonial possessions such as India.
Yeah, because now everyone goes, just a paper tiger.
Yeah, so India, you know, it's East India Company colony, but it's you know, there's still
it's a British colony.
I know, but it's not yet. It comes under direct control later.
But, also, you mean like they still got to do more there and they don't... They feel
there's
this
all
is
these
make
Indian...
Them seem weak and
There's kind of like Indian feudal lords or different princes that still kind of have direct control over certain areas.
So they don't
have
a firm grasp. yet.
Yeah, and okay. There's going to be a huge rebellion right. in about 20 years anyway.
Even though they did, spoiler alert, win the Opium War. It didn't help. Okay.
No, but he's saying like, look, if all these Indian princes realize like, oh,
yeah,
the Chinese can push the British around, then they're going to think, well, we can push them around too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The final vote was 271 to 262, and the motion of censor against Palmerston failed, which was an implicit approval for the war to go ahead.
Ay, 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 ay.
Now, you know, we'll talk about this later, the actual response, but basically the result is, yeah, the parliament's like, okay, get a fleet ready,
yeah,
send it there,
mm-hmm,
and ironically, put Charles Elliot in charge of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll give him a list of demands of what we want.
Right.
And, you know, we're gonna do a war with China.
I don't know. This is my Chinese education.
Yeah, go for
it. You're like, you're going to get mad at me. I mean, I'm not mad at you. I feel like that's a pretty fair assessment, though. There is a lot of hypocritical, like, like things being said on the British Empire's part.
Yeah.
And really, they want to appear to be. And the whole thing about colonialism, British colonialism,
yeah,
is like the propaganda is that they go there, they make it better than like the local lords have treated their people, right? And they industrialize it, they bring civilization.
Well,
and that's all.
That's more modern.
But no, I mean, I don't mean that argument was used at the time. I mean that the there is a parallel of hypocrisy here.
Oh,
there's
yeah,
a parallel of them justifying, them do wanting to look better than what they actually are.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like that's very consistent even at this time. We treat China as, you know, like the whole reason they rejected and started the power vacuum and rejected the request to have Elliot
law
enforcement on the ground is so that they're like, oh, no, the Chinese are going to get mad. But it's like,
it's convenient for them to say that,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Because,
yeah,
I mean, they don't want to, in the end, because if they wanted to, they could just say East India Company, yeah, no more opium.
Yeah.
And then, you know, or they just say British ships can't trade opium anymore.
Yeah.
So opium was actually still legal in England during, mm-hmm, this time period.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like a controlled substance.
Well, people ate opium.
Yeah.
That was a very common thing.
Yeah. So
we'll talk about India next episode.
So to a certain extent, from a British perspective, it's like, well, the Chinese don't like it, but from our perspective, it's like transporting booze. Like,
yeah,
it's like transporting alcohol or something.
Yeah,
like,
but they don't really care that Chinese
don't really
like
care.
It. Yeah.
So they're like, well, we're not going to do anything about it. Like, they underestimated the ability of the Qing Empire to respond to the opium crisis.
Yeah.
I think when Palmerston says, you know, if they get in trouble, just let them deal with it. It's not our problem if a trader gets in trouble for trading opium.
I think that's because when they didn't think Lin Zexu would come in.
Yeah, they
and
think
really
like,
play hardball.
Yeah, they think
and
like
actually mean it.
Yeah, they think like, oh, one guy I'll get arrested to make an example, right?
Yeah.
And just let that guy get in trouble.
Yeah.
They don't think Lin Zexu, yeah, is gonna kick over the whole beehive.
Yeah,
when
the Chinese
everybody.
Government actually inserts authority,
yeah,
of its own law and of its own on its own soil, they're like, nah, actually we're not okay with that.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, so no, I mean, it is kind of a hear no evil, see no evil, like, sort of situation where they're just like, we'll just pretend it's not
yeah,
happening, right? We're just
yeah,
kind of like, and, you know, eventually, because everybody kind of ignored it,
yeah,
it exploded.
Yeah.
And really the people who make out,
mm-hmm,
are the opium traders. Because
yeah,
they're the ones who keep making money hand over fist. And one thing, actually, as a side note, is at this period in time,
mm-hmm,
the opium traders, they don't actually want opium to be legal. Because if it's legal, then like anybody can trade it.
Yeah.
And they've spent
then they
years,
can't make the money.
Yeah, and they spent years and decades building their smuggling networks and all these things. So really, they want it illegal, but just poorly enforced.
Yeah.
Which is,
yeah, cause, I mean, that's the whole thing about legalizing, like, for example, marijuana in like America, right?
Yeah.
Like, take the money out of the black market,
yeah,
and legalize it so that the government can start making the money.
Yeah, but no, they don't want that. They want
yeah,
it to just be.
Not the whole argument. That was part
yeah,
of the that's part of the popular argument.
Yeah, they want it to be the
yeah,
Wild West.
Yeah.
A couple more episodes coming up on this topic. About
the Opium War, the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, the gift that keeps on giving. I actually gave Cherry some homework
yes,
to read the classical Chinese account of the Opium War that was written in like 1843 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And Cherry looked at it and she's like,
it's going to take me a while. I'll try my best.
Giant blocks of classical Chinese.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And have a nice day.
We'll see you next time.